the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Thousands of Central American migrants continue to make their way north. We'll get the latest from southern Mexico. Plus, L.A. has a shortage of foster care homes.
Were it not for the fact that we place over half of our children with relatives, we would be in a circumstance that would be a complete emergency.
And the answer to finding foster families might require a little faith. That's ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is November 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. And before I start the show, I just want to thank everyone that came out to KPCC's open house yesterday. As thrilled as you guys all were to meet Larry Mantle, Nick Roman, Libby Denkman, everyone that works here, we are as excited, maybe even more excited, that you guys decided to take the time out to come visit us. And it was an incredible, incredible day. I always love when KPCC has the open houses. All right. Hope it was a good weekend for all of you. But coming up on the show, we're answer questions about the election that is just 2 weeks away. And we'll hear a story about the history of Prop 13 and how it may still be affecting our current housing market. First, though, thousands of people continue to press north through Mexico. The exact number is hard to pinpoint, but as many as 7,000 men, women, and children, mostly from Honduras, are walking toward the U.S.-Mexico border. President Trump made it a campaign issue last week, but the media is characterizing it as a humanitarian one. Reporter Delphine Schrenk is writing about this for Reuters. She joins us now from the town of Tapachula in southern Mexico. Delphine, you're right in the middle of a town square. Thanks for joining us. I saw a lot of photos over the weekend, pretty much a sea of humanity. Can you describe what it's like down there?
It's incredible. I'm in the middle of a central square in Tapachula. I'm sure you can hear the noise around me. There are thousands of people with bags on their backs, sitting, shielding themselves from a very, very hot sun here in southern Mexico. They slept out here in the middle of this town square after flooding in here on every conceivable patch of available space, under fountains, on rooms of concrete, out in the open in a pouring rain. Basically, you have a huge sea of men, women, and children that I would say like 99% of them are from Honduras. This began in Honduras, this caravan.
Delphine, did you say they're right now hanging out, or are they moving right now?
They are currently hanging out. They're not even sure. I just spoke to a pair of siblings who said to me, you know, we don't know. We don't know if we're leaving today, if we're leaving tomorrow. There was supposed to be a meeting sort of talking to them and telling them what their rights are. They're still here right now, as many of them are trying to figure out what to do. And it's not even clear that all of them are going to head to the United States. But not to say they just want to stay here. They want safety, or they want to find work. And if they can find it in Mexico, they'll stay in Mexico. But many of them, their chief goal is just to get out of Honduras.
So it sounds like right now the plan is just regrouping and then figuring out the next step. Now, President Trump has had some strong words about this group. Here's a clip of that.
These are hardened criminals. These are tough, tough people. And I don't want them in our country.
Do the individuals you've spoken to so far understand the political climate around their journey?
They do, just don't agree. I think no one is deluded that President Trump is opening his arms wide to Central Americans right now in the group that I have, you know, and the many, many people I have been talking to in the past 3 days. On the other hand, the difficulties of their lives really weigh on them, and that just so outweighs any difficulties I think they could face at the U.S. border if they intend to get there, which not all do. So to be honest, the desire to reach safety, to reach a place where they can get some kind of work, is much, much stronger in most of these people's mind. And most of them say repeatedly over and over, they're fleeing some kind of toxic mixture of terrible situations of unemployment. The economy is very bad. And also the violence and the delinquency of gangs that control many of the neighborhoods that they're fleeing. That combination makes it such that they're better off fleeing, they think, and facing America, if you see, and American politics than what they live at home.
Delphine, we just heard the president say that these are hardened criminals. Who is in this group?
It's hard to say if some of them are hardened criminals, but I can tell you the people I've been talking to. A woman who broke down in tears yesterday. She's traveling with her two daughters and had to leave a little son behind. You know, the choices that people are making to abandon their lives. Her siblings I just spoke to who fled at 1 a.m. with nothing, they said, apart from the little backpack they gained along the way because they had been extorted by a delinquent group. These are not criminals as far as I've been able to see. These are people that are fleeing sometimes, most of them, some of them are fleeing the criminals. These are people that are really seeking safety. And as they repeat over and over in a chant, we are workers, we are not criminals. We are the people that are coming, that are going to come and do the hard work. So I would say that what Trump is saying is misinformed.
Delphine, quickly, what is next for them? Are they just going to decide at some point to make their next move, whether it's staying or going?
Right now, they're pondering this, and every individual is pondering this. Right this second in this square where I'm standing, where the majority of this group are, about 3,000, UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, has just appeared and has started roving among them, sort of explaining to them what their rights are. It's a little bit more complicated in Mexico, the rights of seeking asylum, the rights of getting a permit to work, but they're being told that now. But the general idea of this group is that they want to stay together. They know that as a group of several thousand now, they're much better off and it's a much bigger protection against getting deported, against getting robbed and assaulted than if they break off on their own. So they want to stay together, and the decision has yet to be made whether they will move on today.
Reporter Delphine Schrank reporting from southern Mexico about the caravan of people heading north from Honduras. Delphine, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, a little bit closer to home now. The County of Los Angeles just launched an audit looking into the fire department's overtime costs. The audit is expected to be done in December, but the Los Angeles Times ran the numbers and published its results over the weekend. The Times found that overtime made up a third of the average fire department employee's annual pay last year. In other county departments, overtime was just 6%. Matt Stiles has been writing about this for the LA Times. Matt, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Now, give us an overview of your investigation. What numbers did you crunch to come up with these overtime costs?
Right. As you mentioned, there was an audit, and we wanted to get into the bottom of payroll at the fire department. So we pulled a database of everyone's paychecks for the last 5 years. It's something like 100,000 employees in the county. And we found that by far, fire department employees were more likely to make high amounts of overtime, and something like 640 firefighters made $100,000 in overtime last year. And that's many more than anyone at any other department at the county, including the sheriff's department, which obviously requires some overtime, and more than hospitals, public hospitals with doctors. We also found a couple dozen employees who made more than $200,000 in overtime as firefighters last year. So the numbers were kind of eye-popping.
How much of a difference between other departments?
So a big difference. So we had 28 employees at the LA County Sheriff's Office who made a six-figure overtime. And again, there were 645 at the fire department.
Wow. Now, what's the reason for all this overtime pay?
There are multiple reasons. One is that we've been through a period of drought and severe wildfires. And so the fire department not only fights wildfires inside LA County, but they also travel to northern jurisdictions to help out, and also travel to other places like Puerto Rico to help out with hurricanes. And when that happens, there are vacancies and they have to be filled by people in overtime shifts. So other employees will work extra to make up for the vacancies. There are other problems where they had a hiring spur of hiring in the 80s, and those folks are retiring now. So those are vacancies. And then there's also sort of the typical problem that you see in large urban fire departments, where you have constant staffing that's required on each apparatus, three or four firefighters at each station across the jurisdiction, and there's a little strain on the department to fill all those positions.
So just to be clear, it's not just fighting the fires here locally. It's fighting other things in other places that's causing all the hours to pile up.
It is, and there are also issues inside the department in which people can take leave or take time off, and that requires other firefighters to work. They have a pretty generous, employment package at the fire department, and there's this question of whether they're allocating their resources correctly. Would it be smarter to hire more firefighters more rapidly as opposed to paying extra to the ones they have on staff?
Now, what has the fire department said about all this?
Well, they point to, obviously, the important role that the fire department plays both in L.A. County and in the state, and that puts a strain on their resources. They also say they're working to try to get back to the staffing levels that they'd like to have after the economic downturn forced them to stop hiring about a decade ago. So they're doing their best. They don't believe that there's any malfeasance or people fudging the numbers. They just feel like they have a duty to protect the entire county and the region, and that that's expensive.
But don't these overtime costs then filter down to all of us?
They do. And if you think about in the last fiscal year, the department budgeted already $160 million just for overtime, knowing that it's a part of the cost of doing business of running a major urban fire department. They went over that total by $46 million. And so that $46 million could go to other county priorities, including, you know, mental health, probation. It could help with homelessness. So there's a priority at the department to spend money on this and at the county. And, you know, you get the government that you pay for.
Now, the Times did its own audit. The county's official audit isn't expected until December. What do you think the audit will reveal about actions the county needs to take?
We don't know. I know one thing that they are doing is looking at the top overtime recipients to see, you know, to check their time cards and things like that, I presume, to make sure that they're staying in compliance with department procedures. They do have rules to protect firefighters from working too much and to protect the public from fatigue, you know, set in by too many shifts for the firefighters. Another thing that we might see is an increased focus on the county getting reimbursed when it helps other jurisdictions. So if they go to Northern California, do those counties or cities reimburse the fire department for the work that they put in?
Matt Stiles covers LA County for The Times. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We have just over 2 weeks to go before the midterm elections are here, and that means it is crunch time. Your mailboxes are likely brimming with campaign mailers, TV ads for politicians, and ballot measures are absolutely everywhere. And to help you get ready, we're back with our weekly FAQ. That's right, it's time for the Human Voter Guide.
Welcome, human.
The Human Voter Guide.
The Human Voter Guide.
Welcome to the Human Voter Guide.
A real person to help with your election questions.
So you don't have to search for answers.
I just did a little dance to the Human Voter Guide theme song. KPCC's political correspondent Mary Plummer is with me in studio with lots of voting tips. Hello, Mary.
Hi there.
All right, so let's start with today's big deadline. Today is the last day to register to vote before the November 6th election. Where should people go?
The last day, yes. So the last day to register to vote, the website to do that is registertovote.ca.gov. If you have not registered yet, or if you've moved recently and need to update your registration, make sure that you head over to that website today. Today is the last day to register online before the election, and you've got until midnight to do this. The deadline is 11:59 p.m.
I'm not telling anybody what to do, but just save yourself some stress. If you got a second,
don't run it down
to
that last minute,
because then you'll be stressed. All right, there have been some problems lately with voter registrations. The DMV has come under fire for voter registration mistakes that affected tens of thousands of people. Can people, Mary, check their status? And if they can, where should they do that?
Yeah, you know, it is a really good idea to check your registration status online today. It just takes a couple minutes. And that website that I mentioned also includes a place to check your registration. If you go to that page and just scroll down a little bit, you'll see it. Again, the website to do that today is registertovote.ca.gov.
All right, now to a question from a listener. How do people without a residential address, those people who are homeless, how do they register to vote?
We got a couple questions from folks on this. And the key is that you can still register to vote. Here's what you do. When you go to register, you'll see that there is an option to list the cross streets instead of a residential address. So you can put the cross streets that are near where you've been staying. And the reason you do that is so that election officials can assign you a precinct. And if you choose this option, you will need to input a mailing address so that you can receive your sample ballot and other voting materials. Don't worry if you don't have a mailing address yourself. You could use the mailing address for a family or friend. send anywhere that you're able to get mail. Also, a P.O. box would work. And if you do run into any issues or questions, reach out to your county election officials today. We have all of that info up at our website. If you search for voter game plan and head over to LAist.com, we've got lots of resources there to help.
Now, another question we've been getting, people are wondering if they should be worried if they have not yet received their vote by mail ballots. So, Mary, what's the answer there?
So I checked with L.A. County election officials just to get a sense of the timing here, and they say they expect vote by mail ballots should be to all voters by early this week. Now, there is one caveat. If you requested a one-time vote by mail ballot, those can take a bit longer. In fact, you can still request one of those. The deadline to request one is October 30th. But if you typically vote by mail, if you always get your vote by mail ballot, a good rule of thumb is if you haven't received yours by tomorrow or Wednesday, reach out to your county election officials to ask for help and make sure nothing is amiss. We can also help you troubleshoot, so don't hesitate to get in touch. Our email is humanvoterguide@kpcc.org.
All right, now this question also involves vote by mail. What if you've received a vote by mail ballot, but you're thinking you'd rather vote at the polls? How can you do that?
You can. So there are a couple things to keep in mind here, and we want to thank one of our listeners who got in touch, Cheryl Lutz. She lives in Fullerton, and she's been a poll worker for the past 10 years and had some really good tips on this. She said she's seen an increase in people who receive vote-by-mail ballots but would prefer to vote in person, which we totally understand. Her tip is that you need to make sure you bring your vote-by-mail ballot with you.
If they don't bring it with them, they have to vote provisionally or go home and get it. So please bring it with you if you change your mind and decide to vote at the polls.
So bringing it with you allows election officials to know that you haven't voted twice. If you forget it, you'll have to cast a provisional ballot, which will still be counted if you're eligible, but it will have to be verified first. Here's Cheryl Lutz again.
Voting provisionally is fine. It just takes a lot of time, extra time for both the poll worker and the voter.
All right. Now, quickly, speaking of saving time, any tips for voters who want to get a jump on things? Will it be early voting?
Yes. Early voting starts this weekend in both L.A. County and Orange County. L.A. County will have 10 early voting centers open from 8 to 4. And if you live in Orange County, you can vote early at one of 12 locations. We've got all of those details up at our website, LAist.com.
All right. That's KPCC's political correspondent, Mary Plummer. Remember, you can ask us anything about voting. The email is humanvoterguide@kpcc.org. We'll be back next week with more answers to your voting questions. And one more time for the people in the back row. Today, hoy día, is the last day to register to vote before the November 6th election. Do not get left out. The website to register is vote.ca.gov. Mary, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, last week we told you about how L.A. County needs more foster homes. And they had an event in Inglewood where they reached out to a very specific group of people to help them. We'll find out what that is coming up when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. I left out a little something on that website to register to vote. It's called registertovote.ca.gov. That's registertovote.ca.gov. You're going to need that part. All right. 40 years ago, California taxpayers revolted. Voters overwhelmingly passed Proposition 13, a sweeping measure that slashed the state's property taxes. As part of the California Dream Project, Capital Public Radio's Chris Nichols looks at the history of Prop 13 and how the measure continues to shape the state.
Back in the 1970s, California home prices nearly tripled and property taxes soared right along with them.
What we found was that property values were going up every hour.
That's Leslie Davis. She heads the California Assessors Association. In 1978, She was an appraiser for Contra Costa County.
Our phones were ringing off the hook. Folks were concerned about paying their taxes, maybe missing a mortgage payment, maybe not being able to pay their utilities.
People were angry. And Howard Jarvis, who was a taxpayer advocate and fierce government critic, pushed for revolt.
And the politicians, their noses are in the public trough.
He seized on a mistrust of government, including corruption scandals involving local assessors, to rally support for Prop 13. The measure tied property taxes to a home's purchase price instead of to its volatile market price. It also limited how fast a home's taxable value could go up each year. Here's Jarvis at a press conference days before the vote in 1978.
It's to reinstall the basic philosophy that this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and not a government by elected officials, for elected officials, of elected officials.
Despite pleas to vote no by business and labor groups and nearly every newspaper editorial board, Prop 13 was supported by two-thirds of voters. Nearly overnight, homeowners saw property tax bills cut dramatically, and government saw their revenue shrink by nearly half. John Kupal is president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which continues to defend Prop 13.
It helped to maintain the stability of neighborhoods.
He says the measure's greatest success has been helping longtime owners on fixed incomes stay in their homes. People like Dorothy, who lives in North Oakland.
I'm still good when I look at the whole situation. I'm still very blessed.
Dorothy says she bought her modest single-story home in 1956 for $10,000. Today, it's worth more than half a million. She says she'd struggle to stay without Prop 13.
I like my exemptions that I'm getting. I think you earn that as a citizen.
But critics of Prop 13 say that stability for some has come at substantial costs for others. They also say it deprives cities of the revenue needed to adequately pay for schools, parks, and public safety. Less property tax money coming in also meant local governments had to find money somewhere else. Mac Taylor is California's nonpartisan legislative analyst.
There have been local sales taxes. They raise what are called hotel taxes, utility taxes. They turn to assessments. They turn to fees to help backfill some of these costs.
And that's not all.
They also imposed on homeowners and new homes lots of what are called impact fees, where you pay it and it's included in the price of your home.
Those impact fees have pushed housing prices up for new buyers. New homeowners pay significantly more in property taxes than the longtime owners next door.
The clear losers are the millennials.
Dowell Myers is a demography and urban planning professor at USC.
And so the new people come along and they have the highest expenses of house purchase, which they can't really afford. They're saddled with those student loan debts. They have two earners working both to try to pay the mortgage. And they're paying super high taxes to make up for other people's low taxes. They're getting killed.
Prop 13, Myers says, help save the California dream for one generation, but now it's making that same dream tougher for the next. In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
All right, moving on now to a different sort of housing issue. Last week, faith leaders and county officials gathered at a church in Inglewood to talk about foster care. The number of foster homes in L.A. County has decreased from almost 6,000 in 2008 to a little more than 4,000 now. But the number of kids in the system who need a place to stay is right around 18,000. That's a major discrepancy. The question is what to do about it. The person tasked with answering that is Bobby Cagle. He directs L.A.'s Department of Child and Family Services.
I think we have a dire need for foster homes. Were it not for the fact that we place over half of our children with relatives, we would be in a circumstance that would be a complete emergency. I know from doing this work that we really need three foster homes for every child in the system. Not every family is suited for every child, and having three for every child gives us the kind of options that we need in order to be able to best serve the child.
Wondering if when you were in Georgia and you were coming over to take the job here in L.A., if you knew that discrepancy existed for
yes,
L.A.
Yes, and this is a problem throughout the country. Very few locales have all of the families that they need. I also know from having done this work for nearly 30 years that Foster parents, for one reason or another, are continually coming in and out of the system. And so you can never rest, even if you have enough homes.
Based on your time here in L.A. County, and I know asking you to boil it down to one reason is probably not fair to you, but why do you think the discrepancy exists?
You know, to be honest with you, I can't tell you that. I can tell you that we have focused heavily on recruitment of relative family members for children. I can also tell you that we've gone through recently a change in the way that we approve foster families. And that process has been very cumbersome in the outset. We now think we have that under control. But I think that that contributed to the fact that we could not really do recruitment over the past couple of years.
So let's just say my wife and I want to become foster parents. So what do we need to do? How long would it take?
So you have a couple of options. First of all, you could come to our department and file an application, and that would allow us to begin the process of talking with you, looking into your background so that we could determine what your criminal background may be. We also ask for permission to look into other matters like your health, and we do a survey of the home to make sure the home is adequate. And so that process culminates in a full review, and should take between 3 and 6 months.
3 and 6 months. Do you think when people hear that, they don't realize all the steps that are required? And some might think it's invasive.
Some might consider it invasive. What we try to do is to make it as comfortable a process as possible. But I'd have to say that we owe it to these children who have already been hurt, and we have taken them in to care for them. The very worst thing that could happen is for us to place them with a family that, again, hurt them.
So once a family qualifies, they're going to have foster kids in their home. They're paid per child. What, $800 a month, roughly?
Roughly, around $900. That figure is roughly what the USDA says is the cost of caring for a child in the United States today. Then those payments can increase with higher levels of need for children like medical needs.
So outside of the money, what other resources exist for potential foster parents?
We have a warm line that we have just developed, which is a 24-hour-a-day resource that allows foster parents to call in should they need something. We also provide for the child any kind of medical needs that they have, including any kind of psychological needs. And we will bring in-home therapists and wraparound services to serve the child as well as the foster parent if they need it.
Talking to Bobby Cagle, he's the director of the LA County Department of Child and Family Services. Bobby, this brings us to recruitment. So then in terms of recruiting more people to become foster parents, what efforts have been started?
We are reacting in part to a motion that was filed this week by the Board of Supervisors to direct us as a system to recruit through our churches. The faith-based organizations in a community oftentimes are those that help to bring in people to the system.
Now, I can't help but wonder how kids might be matched in this situation, because as we've discussed in the past, there are a lot of kids in the system who identify as LGBTQ, but there are those in the faith community that tend to maybe be more conservative about gender identity issues. Some might not want to open their home to a gay child. How do you plan to deal with that potential issue?
You know, that's a very difficult issue, and I think as a nation, the way that we've dealt with this historically is to try to place children with people who are accepting of children as they are. Then there are other opportunities to recruit in the gay and lesbian community. I am a member of the LGBTQ community, and I will be making a specific effort to recruit LGBTQ foster parents and adoptive parents so that we can provide good homes for these children, and homes that really understand the kind of problems that these children encounter that only people that are LGBTQ can understand.
All right, let's switch gears for a minute, talk about Georgia, where you ran the child services system before coming here. There, the number of kids in the system jumped some 40% during the time you were there. What happened? Why was that the case in Georgia?
That was in the throes of a opiate crisis. And Georgia was one of the states that was hardest hit in the nation during the period that I was there, and that was between 2014 and 2017, mm-hmm. Were kids that were coming in as a result of opiate abuse. And that problem is one that I think that is continuing there, but it was definitely one that was about to overwhelm the system.
And you were trying after that to standardize the way workers took in complaints.
Absolutely. Prior to that, Georgia is a state that has 159 counties. There were 159 different ways of doing intake and child welfare cases. We did standardize that. I think the easier way of reporting for people came right on time because that opiate crisis hit almost simultaneous with that.
Wondering, when we first spoke a while back, you were really honest. You didn't know exactly what you were going to do specifically for LA County. We're trying to compare Georgia and LA. But now that you've been on the job a little while, wondering anything from your time in Georgia that you've been able to use or implement successfully here in LA yet?
Well, I have not done anything as far as major overhauls.
Okay.
I've taken 10 months to really study the system to make sure that whatever I bring here is something that actually suits the system. There are some things that we are doing that we have not waited on. One of those is a revamp of some training in the investigation of cases where children have died. In the aftermath of the Anthony A. case, one of the things that we did was review over 1,000 cases. We took the information from those and expanded samples where we needed to make sure that the quality of the work was good. We also have been a part of the Prevention and Aftercare Network to provide funding to community-based organizations who engage with us and provide services on a voluntary basis to those families that may need it but don't rise to the level of a child who is being abused or neglected.
Bobby, one more thing before we part. You mentioned Anthony Avalos. That's the child who died earlier this year. His mother and her boyfriend have been charged in his death, and earlier this month, prosecutors said they may seek the death penalty. Wondering any word on whether social workers looking into abuse claims at the home will be held accountable?
We had been out of that case for nearly 2 years.
Yeah.
And so the work that was done up to the point that we exited the case was the kind of work that we want social workers doing. I think there is no sure way of assuring that a child will always be safe. That is not the state of the art in social work. And so what we do is try to do everything we can to avoid this outcome. And in that case, I think we did the best that we could do under the circumstances, and then for 2 years didn't have a report.
All right, that's Bobby Cagle. He's the director of LA County Child and Family Services. Bobby, thank you once again for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, Halloween is here. No, not the trick-or-treating holiday, the film. And I know what you're thinking. Haven't I seen this movie before? Yeah, you have. 10 other times. But did Michael Myers' 11th time around the block continue to slay the box office? Find out when Take-Two continues. Back now at Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. A strong October box office just got stronger thanks to a horror film with a female lead over the age of 55. Plus, why Netflix seems to be getting out of the Marvel business. Let's go on the lot.
God, I wish you'd
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Vanity Fair's Rebecca Keegan is our guide to all the latest Hollywood news. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, so let's start as we usually do with the box office. Now, Halloween debuted over the weekend, 11th film in the franchise. Safe to say it beat expectations. How did it do?
It made a killing. Sorry, I apologize to everybody. That wasn't right.
Oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. Well, no, it did great. It made $77.5 million domestically. The previous record for a Halloween film was $26 million. That was back in 2007, the Rob Zombie-directed version. So this movie is second among horror, R-rated horror movies only to It, which opened at $123 million last year. At this time, is the best film to date for Blumhouse, the horror-driven production company that produced it, beating out Paranormal Activity 3, which had been their biggest film. And it's got an 80% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, B-plus cinema score, so it looks to be around for a while.
Remember I told you that my wife and I were going to go opening night?
Yeah.
She was feeling ill this weekend, so we didn't go. But now I think about it, she got ill this weekend in particular.
Right.
So,
Everybody's got a cold in L.A. Yeah, I know, right? I think that's just totally unrelated. But yes, drag her to Halloween next week.
Now, it really did well, better than people expected. What really impressed people is that it did it with a female lead who's almost 60 years old. When's the last time we saw that happen?
Well, that's never happened before. Jamie Lee Curtis, 59, fronts the film. You know, one thing that we've talked about on this show is the paucity of roles for women, particularly for women over 45 in lead roles. They're virtually invisible. It's basically whatever's on Meryl Streep's calendar for the year and then nothing else. So for a movie fronted by a 59-year-old actress to open at $77.5 million is really quite extraordinary.
You think this could maybe open the door to movies with older leads? I mean, horror genre never really falls by the rules anyway, but I'm wondering.
It doesn't. I mean, horror is kind of neat because it's not as expensive, so there's room for taking more risks business-wise. And I think there's an opportunity, not just in horror, but in all kinds of films, to sort of open up who we see as a lead. We've seen that somewhat in more diverse casting, say, in the Star Wars films. So particularly in these franchises where the franchise itself is a draw, you have an opportunity to sort of mint new movie stars, or in the case of Jamie Lee Curtis, remind people why they loved a movie star.
Yeah. Remember how I told you how I judge how good a horror movie is depending on how many punches to the shoulder I get from my wife when she's surprised? So I want to see. Is it a four-punch movie, a five-punch movie? Yeah, I got to take her as soon as I can. All right, let's talk about Halloween producer Jason Blum, who is not having the best week despite the film crushing it at the box office. So catch us up. What's going on with him?
Well, Blum had given an interview to Polygon in which he was asked why Blumhouse has never produced a theatrically distributed movie directed by a woman. He answered in saying that there aren't a lot of female directors, period, and even less who are inclined to do horror.
Cue
the strong reaction, you know, on social media and in the media in general. He had mentioned, by the way, when he answered that he tried to hire Jennifer Kent, the director of The Babadook, multiple times, but that she was never interested in the projects he had to offer. Nevertheless, you know, his comments really did elicit a strong reaction because there are indeed women who would like to direct horror. I know because some of them emailed me about his comments.
What are the stats when it comes to women directors in Hollywood?
Well, you know, according to USC, between 2007 and 2016, women made up about 4% of directors, which is sort of tragically low. But one thing we know, particularly for the kinds of movies that Jason Blum makes, is that you can draw from people in television, as he did in Jordan Peele's film Get Out last year. That was Peele's first movie ever as a film director. He, of course, had done a lot of work in television, and it went on to become a huge success. So although only 4% of the directors of the major big-grossing movies are women, there are a lot of women working in TV, documentaries. There are women screenwriters, producers, actors who probably would like the opportunity to direct a movie for Blumhouse.
You asked the question, if someone would like to direct a big box office Hollywood film, I'm sure plenty of women would raise their hand, right?
Plenty of people raise their hand, for sure.
Yeah. How has Jason Blum responded to all this?
Well, to his credit, he quickly realized that he had stepped in it. He pointed out that over 50% of the audience for Blumhouse films is female, 50% of their execs are female, and he said, quote, "But we have not done a good enough job working with female directors, and it's not because they don't exist."
All right. Now let's move on to Netflix. They made an announcement over the weekend. Luke Cage and Iron Fist will not be returning. So why is this such a surprise for Netflix?
Well, it's interesting because when Netflix ordered these shows back in 2013, it ordered actually 5 Marvel shows at that time. These were shows with big budgets. The intention was to draw Marvel fans to become subscribers to the streaming service. So to cancel these shows is, you know, eyebrow raising.
I gotta admit, you know, it's a superhero thing, so I give all of them a try, and then I just, you know, there's too much else to watch.
Well, that, you know, and I do think that that is part of it. There's an enormous volume of content on the service, and at shows at this budget, you really need to hold on to an audience, not just get people for one or two episodes, but keep them.
Is there anything more to this, though, Netflix and Marvel? I mean, any underlying reason, possibly?
Sure. I mean, there are a couple of reasons. For one thing, Marvel is famously controlling creatively, which has worked very well for them, particularly on their film properties. According to some reporting in the Hollywood Reporter and on Deadline, there were creative differences, particularly on the Luke Cage project, between what Marvel wanted to do with the show and what Netflix wanted to do with the show. But there's a larger, I think, strategic issue at play here, and that has to do with Disney's forthcoming streaming service, which they plan to launch in 2019. Disney is going to be migrating its Marvel films from Netflix over to the new streaming service. They're creating new Marvel shows for their streaming service. It's a safe assumption that the Marvel shows that are on Netflix will ultimately end up on Disney's streaming service as well.
I know DC is going to create their own channel for all their own stuff, too. It was whispered about years ago with all the comic book geeks I know.
Well, and eventually we're all going to have, you know, 6 or 7 streaming service subscriptions.
And have less time, right?
Just as bad as it was with cable. So, yeah, now, less time, less money.
Rebecca, some personal news for yourself. In a few weeks, you'll be joining The Hollywood Reporter. What's your new position?
I will be senior editor film. Ooh. I'll be writing features and news about film, the Academy, the Oscars, a lot of things that we talk about here every week.
So LA Times, Vanity Fair, now Hollywood Reporter. So what are you going to look forward to the most?
Well, I think I'm looking forward to being back in a big newsroom. You
know, oh, really? Okay.
Reporters are nuts, but they're my people.
And if you identify with them,
yes.
Then you are of a certain kind of brand.
That's
right?
for sure.
All right. Rebecca Keegan is with Vanity Fair. She joins us every Monday to talk about the business of Hollywood. Rebecca, congratulations. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, fair to say the L.A. dining scene has an untraditional, relaxed, rules-free kind of vibe. But does that make L.A. diners just plain rude? Why can't I have my fish and chips boiled instead of fried? Hey, I don't care if there's a full house. I have to have my coffee refilled a minimum of 4 times. Well, a server from the Bay Area who moved to L.A. wrote an op-ed titled, "Dear Los Angeles, you seriously need to learn how to behave in restaurants." Hear why when Take Two continues. She's actually going to be here in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Nearly a decade ago, restaurant server and comedian Natalie Gregory moved to Los Angeles. She'd been a server in the Bay Area. As she started working in LA's food scene, Gregory noticed Angelinos behaved a lot differently. It was not pretty. She wrote about her complaints in the recent LA Times op-ed, "Dear Los Angeles, you seriously need to learn how to behave in restaurants." Natalie Gregory is here now to talk about the bad, the ugly, and maybe even the good of LA's food lovers, and also to offer advice to improve both the servers and the patrons' restaurant experience. Welcome to Take Two.
Great to be here.
All right, you worked at both fine dining restaurants and a pizza place in the Bay Area. What
yes.
types of restaurants have you worked at here in Los Angeles?
Lots of different types, but I've tended to stray away from fine dining just because you have to be very formal. I'm not a very formal person. So kind of a lot of gastro pubs, bistros,
okay.
That kind of thing. So, you know,
for some people, that's fine dining, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So like a little bit, you know, nice, but still, you know, you can wear jeans and you're not going to get, you know, thrown out the door.
Now, what kinds of differences did you notice about restaurant patrons in L.A. versus the Bay Area when you started kind of getting involved in the whole scene?
Sure. Well, I would definitely notice kind of the pickiness of the eating a little bit, I would say. Trying to modify the menu, absolutely. Someone asked me once if they could use the fish that was fried with the fish and chips. And could we boil it and put it on the side of a salad? She basically wanted, like, I think, like an ahi salad, which we didn't have. Mm. So it was kind of like, well, yes, we can boil that fish, but that fish is meant for frying. Mm. So you might not enjoy it as
much. So we're menu modifiers, is what you're saying. LA is menu modifiers. Yeah.
A little bit. And I think that's kind of built in the sort of like health food culture that's down here, which I think is great. You know, I love a good juice or a good smoothie like anybody. But, you know, I just would recommend if you're a vegetarian, maybe not going to eat an animal.
So what qualifies then as bad behavior then for LA restaurant goers?
I think we could all just be a little bit more kind to servers. And when we walk into a restaurant, they want you to have a good time. You know, I want you to have a good time. And, you know, I don't want you to walk away feeling bad or that your experience was horrific. At the same time, I think we could all just be a little bit more patient and realize that you're there to enjoy the food. And I think this has changed a lot in the 9 years I've lived here. But LA restaurants, it's a kind of about being perhaps seen and noticed, and it's the layout of the restaurant and the way the decor looks, and not necessarily the food.
Well, my big break might be around the corner, Natalie. We're talking to Natalie Gregory. She wrote the LA Times op-ed, Dear Los Angeles, You Seriously Need to Learn How to Behave in Restaurants. Now, in response to your article, we asked people on Facebook to share their thoughts about the behavior of LA servers. Wait till you get this one. Here's what one of our followers, Jim Hester, wrote on our page. Jim said, I read her op-ed piece. She forgot that her job is to serve customers. The customers are not there for her. Yes, customers should be courteous, but they're there for the meal, not for the server. Natalie?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. They're not there for the server. You know, they're there for the food and the experience, and I totally agree with that. You know, I feel like my main message of the piece, again, it's about kindness. Let's all just be nicer to each other. Let's understand, you know, and to servers too, recognize that people are there to have a good time and try to facilitate that good time in a polite, efficient manner. And likewise, for people who go out to eat, recognize that your server is a human with feelings and thoughts and parents and aunts and uncles. And if they're good, they're trying to make you have a good time. So I think it's just a two-way street of, like, let's all be nice to each other.
Be a human on your time.
Yes.
Bring me my fifth cup of coffee. Now, in your article, speaking of coffee, you wrote this about brunch patrons. Mm-hmm. You don't need to keep asking me for coffee. I already know you need a gallon of it, but we only have so many coffee pots. I'll get to you when I can. Now, some might argue that the customers should be able to ask for coffee during brunch as many times as they want, and that servers are there to give the patrons a good experience, not the other way around. Natalie?
If you ask any server who works brunch, they will tell you that is the worst shift. And it's chaotic and crazy. And yeah, I mean, I did work at this one place where, that, you know, it's nonstop with the coffee. And it was a thing of just, like, you know, finite resources. Like, I could only get a coffee pot to them so much, but I would, because I got asked for it so much. And when you're juggling, you know, 6-7 tables, that's a lot of coffee. And so I know it's the morning, guys, but the coffee machine can only produce so much coffee, and I do have to compete with it with other servers. And I remember one time in like the server room of this restaurant, we all had a conversation, like, Natalie, how much coffee do you like to give, like, fill people up? And they were asking, like, do you give them, like, 2, 3, 4 cups? I was like, I just keep filling it.
The one problem I would have with that is that I have a very delicate mix in terms of cream to Splenda to coffee. And then all of a sudden, I've got it perfectly. I'm drinking it. It's halfway through. And all of a sudden, it gets filled up again, and the whole chemistry set is ruined.
Yeah. Well, I always, you know, I bring the coffee pot, more coffee, more coffee. I do the, you know, do you need the coffee? Because I know what you mean. I have a sweet spot, too, with my cream and sugar. So
you really must have really noticed all these differences, because I always figured the diners are kind of the same everywhere, but LA is really different.
Probably it's actually just everywhere. Like, it's our culture of how we eat out in restaurants, perhaps in the country, and maybe we need to look at that and change the way we behave altogether as a nation.
Natalie Gregory is a server and comedian living in Los Angeles. She wrote the LA Times op-ed, Dear Los Angeles, You Seriously Need to Learn How to Behave in Restaurants. Natalie, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. It's been a blast.
That's it for Take Two today. I'm Amy Martinez. Just another reminder, today is the last day to register to vote for the November election. That means it's the last chance to make sure your voice is heard. Do not miss out. Coming up tomorrow, we'll tell you what you need to know about the appellate court judges and the state Supreme Court. Why do we get to vote for them? We've got answers. And hey, if you want to learn more about what's going on and what's going to be on your ballot next month, we have got your back. Our voter game plan has all the information you need to make an informed choice. It's fast. It's easy. Just head on over to elections.laist.com. That's elections.laist.com. All right. Coming up next, Air Talk with Larry Mantle. Hey, Larry.
Hi, hey. Great that you're going to join us again today for the Triple Play.
World Series edition.
Dodgers in the World Series in a huge task, taking on the favored Boston Red Sox starting tomorrow in Boston Fenway Park. So we'll talk about that. Also, we're going to open up the phones for listeners to weigh in the wake of Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator, disclosing her distant Native American ancestry. I'm going to ask listeners, when do they feel comfortable referring to a racial or ethnic background? Okay. How many generations back? Or when would they be shy about sharing that with other people, feel it would be too distant, too diluted to bring up? We'll talk about that coming up, too.
I've always wondered, I wanted to try and see. I don't, I'm afraid of what I'd find.
Have you done the,
no,
the
I
genetic
haven't.
Test?
I've kept it. I've kept my genetics, my genes, my DNA hidden, locked in my own personal vault.
Pretty interesting.
All right. That's Air Talk coming up at 10. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, A.